from KQED.
Welcome back to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. 58 former senior national security officials, both Democrat and Republican, released a statement today saying there is, quote, no factual basis for the president's declaration of a national emergency to build a wall on the border with Mexico. Meanwhile, President Trump heads to Vietnam and a second summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Joining us to talk about these stories and the latest on the Russian investigation, is NPR's Ron Elving. He's senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk. And welcome, Ron.
Good to be with you.
Good to have you. And let's begin with 58 security officials. Bipartisan, what does this mean in terms of the national emergency, especially when you've got 16 attorneys general going after the president in litigation?
It's remarkable that around the country, as you say, 16 states have said this is absurd. This is not an emergency. There is an issue about how we handle the southern border. There is a question about what is the best way to reduce the flow of illegal drugs and the traffic and illegal immigration. But an emergency has a particular meaning, not only in the English language, but also in the actual law that was passed in 1976 and that the president is relying on here in shifting money around. And so the president declares a national emergency without the kind of basis that all previous national emergency declarations have had. Most of those had to do with foreign situations. Most of them had to do with foreign governments or individuals. This is a different matter, and the president is using the declaration to get around the usual process, the constitutional process by which money is spent by our federal government.
So what does this statement by these 58 security officials say? I mean, the language is such that it says, in effect, that we don't need this national emergency. It's not necessary.
It's a double signal. It's a double message, if you will. It is saying that we need to deal with the problems that are associated with the southern border, but it is not a national emergency in the meaning of the law. And that's important because they're sending a message here to Republican senators, quite frankly. There will be perhaps one or two Republicans in the House who vote tomorrow to approve this resolution that would end or block the national emergency declaration. But what people are really looking for is a half dozen Republican senators in the Senate, because that would then pass the resolution in the Republican majority chamber of Congress. That would send it on to the president's desk. So there's a signal being sent by these security officials, and also, I should add, by 24 retired Republican lawmakers, people from Congress who are Republicans, saying to their brethren and sisters in the House and Senate, you should not be letting your loyalty to President Trump or your political fealty to President Trump and his supporters govern your judgment on this. It's a clear constitutional question, and constitutional conservatives should be on the right side of it. So it's a signal to those members of Congress who are going to vote beginning tomorrow in the House. And it's also ultimately a signal to the courts to say that the cumulative judgment in both political parties over a number of administrations can be brought to bear here in deciding whether or not the president is within his bounds.
Speaking about the president and his bounds, he's off to Vietnam, and there's going to be a summit with Kim Jong-un, and there seems to be, well, again, shall we say, some disagreement coming about what the president has supposedly tweeted in terms of denuclearization and the reality of what we face in terms of this summit.
The president tends to be direct and let us say, go to the essence of his point when he sends tweets, and so he has tweeted, there is no longer a nuclear threat from North Korea. Well, his own Secretary of State has had to step away from that, maybe not back down exactly. He says there's much less nuclear threat from North Korea, but he does also say that nuclear power and nuclear weapons, rather, in North Korea do constitute a nuclear threat to its neighbors, Japan, to China, to other parts of Asia, and ultimately to the United States as well, not just Guam, but all the way to Hawaii and all the way to California. Eventually, as the North Koreans develop their nuclear threat technology, their nuclear capabilities, we have learned since that summit earlier last year in Singapore that North Korea has actually quite a few nuclear facilities we did not even know about before that. They're not being dismantled. It's true they haven't had any more nuclear tests, and it's true that they haven't been firing missiles into the Pacific the way they were doing. But they have not in any other sense denuclearized, nor do they seem to show any interest in it. And the president, on the one hand, says that's the price for our taking off the sanctions. But then on the other hand, he says, I think we're going to get a deal, and I think everything's going to be fine because Kim Jong-un and I see eye to eye.
They see eye to eye in both wanting a Nobel Prize, according to some reports.
He has shown an interest in that. He keeps bringing it up. He keeps mentioning the Nobel Peace Prize. And he says that he was going to be nominated for this by Japan. Well, that turned out to be something of an embarrassment to the officials in Japan, that he was citing whatever they actually thought or whatever they actually had communicated. They were embarrassed.
Forgive me, Ron. There was a letter by Abe, at least
yes,
reportedly.
Yes, exactly. And the question here is, on what level was that that communication being made? And how serious was Abe about it? It's quite an embarrassment, I understand, for him back in Japan. But at any rate, the president has shown a great deal of interest in being given a Nobel Peace Prize. And of course, he sees that as being his due for having had now two meetings with Kim Jong-un.
Well, he's also going to Vietnam at a time when Michael Cohen, his consigliere or fixer, whatever we want to call him, is going to be testifying this week. So there will be some attention that will go to that as well. And will Vietnam be able to sort of take the oxygen away from that? Because it's also pretty embarrassing, I think, or going to be.
When a president travels overseas, he always takes with him an entourage of media, and they are going to feed back an enormous amount of coverage and an enormous amount of video, and people are going to watch it, and there's really no way around it. There's also a tremendous irony, of course, in having President Trump go to Vietnam. He did not go when the Vietnam War was calling, and when he was in service age, he had a deferment for bone spurs, and we have subsequently learned a good deal about the doctor who gave him that deferment. But he is going to Vietnam. Now he is going to meet with the North Korean leader, and it's going to be a spectacle. And much will be done to make it look like a very successful conference, and perhaps it will be. But whether it is in fact or not, much will be done to make it look like a successful summit. And the president just a little while ago was saying that he believed it was going to be a very, very good summit, and then he said a very tremendous summit, and that he thought that not only had they already achieved more than anyone else has achieved with North Korea, but that he thought they were going to get it all done. So there will be that. On the other hand, you also have videotape of Michael Cohen coming to Capitol Hill, not once or twice, but three times this week for hearings before the intelligence committees behind closed doors on Tuesday and Thursday, and also for an open session with the House Government Reform and Oversight Committee on Wednesday. And that should be a real show.
Since you mentioned Vietnam and we're talking about North Korea, we should also remember that the president said that his Vietnam was his concern about getting HIV or AIDS during days when he was, I guess, known for his bachelor attitudes, to put it euphemistically. But also, as far as North Korea is concerned, he also has said that we would have been at war had it not been for his intercession. We would be at war with North Korea.
There is this. The President Obama said to Donald Trump, apparently, when they met briefly in the White House at the point of the transfer of power when Donald Trump was being inaugurated president, President Obama said, I think your biggest foreign policy immediate problem is going to be North Korea. You really are going to have to deal with that as soon as possible. That's a very serious situation. Apparently, Donald Trump has taken that to mean that if it hadn't been for his being elected, either Hillary Clinton or perhaps Barack Obama was going to, in some sense or another, make war on North Korea. I'm not sure how he makes that bridge, but he implies that that warning from President Obama was a signal that we were reaching the point of hostilities with North Korea. Don't believe that's the way President Obama remembers it.
Well, if you have a question or a comment about any of these stories we're covering with Ron Elving, who, again, is senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News, we do welcome your involvement in the program, and we do invite you to join us now. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, and you can join us at that number again, wherever or however you're listening to us. The number to call, 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Welcome your thoughts about not only the summit, as we've been talking about it, that's going to be taking place in Vietnam on North Korea, but also any thoughts you have about security advisors and people in the security business who are saying that the national emergency that the president has declared is not a national emergency and should not indeed be considered a national emergency. Also, want to bring up the Mueller investigation with you, Ron. And at this point, we were hearing a lot of chatter about the fact that things were going to be revealed and they were going to go to Attorney General this week. That is Barr, Attorney General Richard Barr. But at this point, it looks unlikely this week. And what do we know on a timeline, if anything?
We don't know when we're going to see the report. There's some chance that they decided not to release it this coming week because the president is going to be overseas. And it would be seen as perhaps less than kosher activity from them to put it out while he was not in the country. I don't know. I don't know whether that was the reason they didn't or if the report isn't finished, but there were a lot of smoke signals about it being ready to go last week, and then that was rescinded on Friday afternoon. The Justice Department said flat out it won't be next week, and maybe not the week after. Well, we don't know about the week after, and we don't know about the week after that. So it would appear at this point not months, but more likely weeks before we see the Mueller report. And we don't know if it's going to be a complete report or a final report or an interim report or something which is so heavily redacted, as it were, or kept under wraps so that the Attorney General says, I've got the report and I'll tell you what you need to know, but the rest of it is all privileged information, or it regards people that are not being indicted, therefore we're not going to share it. So we don't really know how much the report will consist of and how much it will represent of what Robert Mueller actually knows.
Hasn't the AG said, though, that he will be transparent with the public and Congress as much as he can do that? I mean, he usually used the word transparent.
He said that that would be his goal, but he also said he would be following the guidelines of the Department of Justice and its past practice, which has been, and I'm going to add a caveat here in a moment, but it has been that if you don't indict someone, you don't talk about them. You don't go out and trash them and say, but we didn't indict this person. So in the case, of course, of 2016 with James Comey, when he announced that they were not going to file any charges with regard to Hillary Clinton's email server and all of that episode, he also went on at some length about his disapproval of the way she handled her email server and called it reckless and that sort of thing. And then, of course, he intruded himself in the situation again in the fall by saying they were reopening that investigation for a brief time, and then a week later saying, well, nope, nothing to see here. So we have seen in that instance and in other instances of Justice Department activity in recent years some departure from those guidelines and from that past tradition of reticence. So the real question here is, what does William Barr see his ultimate responsibility as being? Is it to the president who appointed him? Is it to the Congress, which he will doubtless be called before to explain himself? Or is it ultimately to the American people as a whole, with the sense of, I've got to lay all this out there or there will be questions forever?
Again, we're with Ron Elving, and if you'd like to join us, the number to do so is 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Let's go to Kristen. Kristen, you're on the air. Kirsten, excuse me.
Thank you. Yes, thank you. I'd like to make a comment about your remarks about what former President Obama may or may not have said to President Trump, and that is that North Korea always takes advantage of a transition between our administrations, or when they think that we have a foreign policy priority which is more important than theirs. And I think this has been going on since at least 2002. So any conversation that happened in the last transition would be par for the course.
Hmm. Thoughts, Ron?
Indeed, there have been many countries that have seen the arrival of a brand new administration as a moment to test the new administration or to test the boundaries. But my impression here, again, this all is coming secondhand and third hand, but my impression of that exchange between the incoming president and the outgoing president was that President Obama was trying to warn Donald Trump that that there would be this kind of testing coming, and probably North Korea was the likeliest country to test his mettle right out of the box.
But there have been no more nuclear tests by North Korea, and that's something the president keeps reassuring about.
Certainly that is a positive development. And if they are not firing missiles into the sea or in the direction of other countries, that is also a positive development. It does not amount to either denuclearization or any sort of disarmament on the part of North Korea. It could be a pause. It could be an indication of their sincerity in negotiation. But it does not begin to approach what has been demanded by the United States in the past and what President Trump continues to say is our standard. If we're going to lift the sanctions, they have to denuclearize and end their nuclear threat. Even Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, says they have not done that.
And let me thank Kirsten for the call and go to a listener comment. It's a statement that a listener writes and says, Trump does have a clear constitutional basis for declaring his national emergency in Article 4, Section 4, quote, guarantee to each state protect from invasion.
If you view the situation on our southern border as an invasion, and that is a word that President Trump has certainly used on a number of occasions, that would be an emergency by that definition. However, what he's really doing here is not meeting an invasion. He is spending money that has not been appropriated by Congress. So while you have your Constitution out, you should probably check the first article, and particularly the line about money being spent only by consequence of legislation in the form of appropriations.
And Congress having the right of appropriations. I want to go to something else, though, in light of sentencing that's going up ahead with Paul Manafort, and get your thoughts, Ron. I mean, it would appear at this point that Paul Manafort's going to spend a long time in prison unless the president pardons him. And the report that was put out, the sentencing memo that was put out, was really pretty scathing.
It was extraordinarily scathing, even though we only got to see about a 25-page summary out of what is described as being more than 800 pages of information about Paul Manafort. But this word hardened applied to criminal really made him sound like a kind of gangster who's been running around the world working for governments of questionable nature and for autocrats and for people who in the Russian system we usually think of as being organized crime, exactly. That's really what we would call them, not just oligarchs, not just people who have made a lot of money, but people who have been involved in organized crime. So this is the man who was then made the chairman of President Trump's campaign back in 2016, and he saw that as another opportunity to get well or to get even or to get straight with many of the people he owed money back in that part of the world. We don't know what that entailed. We don't know how much was a result of that. We just know that already at this point, Robert Mueller has put out an extraordinary amount of indicting material, not only in the Virginia case where he's been found guilty and here in D.C. where he has pled guilty to all of these counts, which could add up to more than 30, some maybe 40 years in jail if they were all to be brought to bear. I think at this point, everyone assumes the president is going to have to pardon him. I think Paul Manafort has to assume the president is going to pardon him. And then there's yet another specter out there on the horizon for him, and that is that the state of New York has started talking about putting together a prosecution of Paul Manafort, and that would be beyond the president's power to pardon.
Well, there's still a big question about the role of Konstantin Khlimnik, Russian, actually, who had all kinds of ties to not only Ukraine, but also to Russia itself, and what role he played, particularly in giving Manafort polling data that went back to the campaign. And now we hear from Donald Trump Jr. that it's interesting you talk about the portrayal of Paul Manafort as a gangster, coming to Manafort's defense and saying that Manafort is being portrayed as a criminal. He's just an ordinary guy. And these kinds of things go back to, he didn't use this word, but I'll use it again, antediluvian state, or go back to ancient times, these things that he's been charged with and found guilty.
Well, they are, in some cases, they are older actions, but they do go to the heart of the things that he did in 2016, and that, I think, is what interests the larger body politic. Why was Paul Manafort having these meetings with people like Khlimnik? Why was he handing them polling data from the campaign? Was that part of a coordinated effort to know how to use the social media campaign that was being organized by some of Vladimir Putin's closest friends to give people misinformation about the 2016 campaign and do it under the guise of being ordinary Americans just sharing information with each other? How much of that was coordinated? And if it was, does that not amount to some form of conspiracy and break the laws of the United States? This is why this man is not just being punished for what he did in the distant past, but for what he did in the 2016 campaign.
And we'll bring on another caller, and that's you, Ruth Ann. Join us. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. I wanted to ask Ron Elving what his thoughts were on folks who come to the defense, not to make a bad pun, of North Korea by stating that their position is largely that if they gave up their nuclear arsenal, it would be suicidal. It's the only credible defense they have against powers like the United States that are intent on regime change?
That's a good and important question, I think, Ruth Ann. I thank you for it. And there's also those who say, look what happened to Libya when they gave up their nuclear weapons. North Korea must be thinking about that.
Yes, the case of Libya was highly unusual for a country to say, we've thought we needed to have these to defend ourselves in this dangerous part of the world, but we're willing to give them up for the assurances of other nations that we won't suffer. The fate of Muammar Gaddafi does not stand as an encouragement to others who would do the same. So this is also the case with, take a country like Iran, where they do not have a nuclear weapon yet, we don't believe, and yet they're trying to develop one so that they would have a certain kind of standing in that part of the world. This has been a motivation for governments all over the world, going all the way back to when the Soviet Union was trying to steal the technology from us in the 1940s. So once a country gets this, they do see it as an existential line of defense for themselves, and it does, after all, change the level of respect that they get in the international community. Witness what Donald Trump's been willing to do for Kim Jong-un.
And I thank the caller, Ruth Ann, and go to another caller, and that's Rachel. Rachel, join us.
Good morning. I'm curious about Ron Elving's comment about the international trip flooding the media with images and whatnot of a president's international trip versus the editorial choice that media outlets could make to focus on the wall not being built by Mexico, as Donald Trump initially said it would be. And I'd like Ron Elving to comment on this broader concept of editorial choices that our new media outlets make.
Okay. Thank you for the question, Ron.
It will be interesting to watch how various news organizations balance their time on Wednesday in particular. Wednesday is an ideal day to do this. There will be news from Vietnam. There will be news from Capitol Hill, where Michael Cohen is testifying. There may well be news on other fronts as well. And as the caller suggests, there is always the ongoing story of what is happening with the wall, what is happening with the government emergency. All of these things are at a pretty full boil this week, and we will see how various news organizations apportion their time. I know at NPR we're going to make every effort to cover all of these things. I know that we have reported countless times that the president promised us that Mexico would pay for the wall, and other news organizations surely have reported this a good deal as well. But we will try to give equal is a problematic word. We will try to give considered and thoughtful weight to all of these stories, depending on what actually gets said, what actually happens, what we can credit from any of these various sources of information and news, and try to mix and blend all of those impressions as best we can. And we're going to be asking our audiences for a lot of their time on Wednesday and the rest of this week and probably the rest of this year and next year to pay attention to what's going on in Washington and in our politics and particularly in our presidential election.
It's a platitude, but we certainly all have our work cut out for us. Here's a tweet from Carl who says, no more nuclear tests by North Korea. More likely they exhausted their supply of explosive devices and rockets. And Maxwell asks, why is nuclear testing considered the benchmark? Is it possible that North Korea is not testing anymore because they have successfully achieved nuclear weapons?
We would have to say that the United States has not tested any nuclear weapons in a very long time. But I don't believe anyone thinks that that undercuts our nuclear capabilities or that that means we have denuclearized or that we could never, as a military, pose a nuclear threat to someone. So the caller raises the listener raises an excellent question. Why are we fixated on whether or not there have been tests? we should be looking for evidence that they are actually denuclearizing, taking down the weapon systems, taking down the production system. There was a report just today out of Stanford that that North Korea has obtained a rather large supply of nuclear fuel to be used for another generation of nuclear weapons that they don't or didn't have last summer, but that they're working on now.
Here's a question that I'd like to throw in the mix of all this national news we're covering. It's closer to home here. As I know you're well aware, Ron, our California Senator Dianne Feinstein is taking a lot of heat for a standoff she had on Friday with a group of school children who actually confronted her about her refusal to support the Green New Deal. Your thoughts?
This was a really unfortunate moment and look for Senator Feinstein. One has to be, I think, sympathetic that she was, you know, perhaps not prepared for what was about to transpire in meeting with these young people. My heart goes out to the kids. My heart goes out, I think, a little bit to the older person who wasn't really ready to deal with them and their challenge to her. But Dianne Feinstein, you know, last year there was a hearing with the Facebook folks and a lot of other people from the tech community. She did not seem to be entirely on top of all of that material. And I'm not sure she was entirely prepared to deal with questions about the Green New Deal. There's a lot to debate in the Green New Deal. There are a lot of questions about how far it would go, just how far away, how fast would we move away from the culture that we live in today, not just with fossil fuels, but with forms of agriculture and eating meat and so on. Not everyone is ready to do that overnight. Some people are. But Dianne was not quite ready to meet with these young people or quite prepared for how insistent they were going to be.
Well, the Green New Deal was something we took up here on Forum. It's in our archives, and I do recommend listeners listen to that hour. It was very informative. So Skip wants to know, when is the Mueller report going to be released? I mean, we have a new AG. Let's move on, he says.
Sometime in March would be my guess, and I know that's not terribly specific, but I don't think we're looking at another full month. I think we're looking at something more in the neighborhood of 2 weeks.
And maybe we can fit in another quick question from you, Ross. Ross, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I was just calling because I'm not an apologetic for Paul Manafort, and thank you for taking my call, but I wonder if the systemic problem that created the fact that Paul Manafort or people like him could make money from doing what he did in Washington throughout the world should be addressed or at least discussed as part of this conversation rather than the single action of a man that relates to a single...
Yeah, Ross, thank you for that. We're up against the clock here. And what about following through along the lines Ron just outlined? Ron?
I quite agree. We should talk about Paul Manafort for certain, but not just Paul Manafort, because he represents the worst of a very much larger culture that we really need to take a long look at and see if this is the way we want our government to be influenced.
Well said, and a good place to conclude. Always good to have you with us, Ron. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk of NPR News. We'll be back. We're going to talk about the Oscars next. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of the Minetti Schremm Museum of Art at UC Davis. On view through April 14th, Blue and Yellow Corridor, an iconic work by Bruce Nauman, realized on the very grounds where the artist conceived it.